with information on the latest developments in assistive technology and initiatives from the studios of 2RPH in Sydney. RPH Australia brings you AbleQuest.
Hello, I'm Barbara Sullivan. Our guest today is Morwenna Collette, a specialist on disability in the music industry and a 2019 Churchill Fellow. I spoke to her on AbleQuest last year before she departed on her 60-day intensive research trip. Fortunately, she arrived back before the COVID lockdown, and we caught up again to talk about how the trip went. I began by asking Morwenna what research question she set out to answer.
The question that I wanted to have a look at through this particular piece of research was, how can the Australian music industry include more disabled artists, participants and audiences? So I really wanted to come at this from a very holistic approach. So often organisations focus on access for audiences, but I was really interested in also exploring how people with disability can play a creative role in music making as well.
Winning the Churchill Fellowship and going on this amazing trip, talking to world leaders in the area, must be a career highlight for you. But also, importantly, it's salutary for the Australian music industry, I imagine, that you have so many learnings from this trip. Do you feel the trip was successful on those two fronts?
Absolutely. Look, it was absolutely a life and career highlight. It did go beyond my wildest dreams in terms of what I was able to find out, the connections and the networks that I was able to build, the work that I was able to see. It was a really incredible undertaking. And I think the Churchill approach is such an interesting one because it's for a period of between 4 to 8 weeks overseas, and I really did experience the value in being able to see people face to face and have real and frank conversations with them at their place of work, in their concert halls, in their venues that would have been difficult to do via Zoom. So I know the world will look different as we move forward now, so I'm very pleased to have snuck this in when I did.
Yes, absolutely. Looking at your itinerary, which extends to pages and pages and pages, it literally is the who's who of music organisations in the US and in England, Scotland and Ireland, from the Met in New York to Glastonbury Festival. Talk to me about the number of interviews and how you went about setting this up and how successful all that was, fitting it in.
Yeah, it certainly took a bit of logistical organising. So I was away on the Churchill Fellowship for a period of 60 days, and in that time I did 83 interviews with 72 organisations and 124 individuals. So what that meant was that on a day-to-day basis I'd have anywhere between, on a nice easy day, perhaps one interview, through to the entire week I was in Scotland, I had back-to-back 4 interviews a day. And of course, at the end of the day, you're writing up interview notes, you're preparing for the interviews that you're doing the next day, also trying to be a mum to my 7-month-old baby and my partner who I had with me. So it was intense. And I think when I was putting together the itinerary, what I was trying to do is really focus on music organisations that already had a very successful active engagement with people with disabilities. So really looking to the world leaders that have been doing this for some time that we could get the most learnings from back here in Australia. The UK is certainly where it's at. They've been across the thinking around the social model of disability for quite a while now. In the States, they've got the Americans with Disabilities Act, which has been in place for a while. So they were certainly the places that, with the time available, I wanted to spend my time. In some organisations, the access manager was able to have influence across the whole organisation, but in others, there was, I guess, a frustration that access is seen as something that the education department does or that the marketing department does. So I think one of the challenges for organisations internationally around this is, how do we get cut through across an entire organisation? And I certainly met with organisations that had done that successfully and others that were sort of working towards getting that holistic approach to access happening as well.
Not so long ago, I interviewed one of the people from the Smithsonian in Washington. She said what made the difference to their program there, which is world leading, was the fact that the director, one of the key executives, is disabled herself.
Yes, yes. And unfortunately, that was certainly one of the things I highlighted in my report, I was conscious that I was meeting with a lot of non-disabled people that were in these roles. And I think that's really interesting to unpack why that's happening. Are people with disability not going for those roles? Are they not being successful in these roles? Are they not seeing the arts as a place in which they can work? But I certainly made a conscious effort to meet with as many people with disability in the music industry as possible. And I suppose the bulk of those were actually disabled musicians themselves. Certainly that was something on my radar, is that we've got some more work to do in terms of opening up employment opportunities for people with disability within the music industry as well. And I think that's going to be a key part to success for us.
What did you find were the main reasons these organisations that are considered to be the world leaders in this area were interested in being inclusive?
There were four main reasons, I suppose, why the organisations I met with were doing work in this space. Most people would talk to me about the moral imperative, that this was the right thing to do. Most people had a really strong sense of that. Sadly, less organisations, but indeed some, mentioned the fact that it makes good business sense. By becoming more accessible, you're opening yourself up to being able to sell more tickets, you know, you're getting a wider reach, that kind of thing. Other organisations talked to me about an artistic rationale. So the work of disabled musicians is really exciting, and I guess that's one of the main reasons that brought me to this project, because that's something that I really believe and enjoy, a lot of work by artists with disability, and think it's very, you know, not to generalise too much, but can be really interesting and cutting edge and experimental, and that's one of the things that attracts me to it. And the fourth reason why people were looking to be inclusive, perhaps less sexy, but for where there's a funding requirement to do so, or even a legislative requirement in the US, I found out something interesting talking to an organisation called 1050 Entertainment, that under the Americans with Disabilities Act, if someone requests a sign language interpreter for a music festival, one has to be provided. It's not a negotiable thing here. The legislation is really strong and really clear. Unless there's a financial hardship on the festival, that means they can't provide that, they must provide that. So I think the legislative side of things, particularly in the United States, definitely played a part too in why people were doing this work.
Were there any cases you came across that made the business sense case, that basically you will sell more tickets, you'll reach a wider audience?
Well, there's an interesting organisation in the UK called Attitude is Everything, which is about making live music accessible to more people, and they work with a lot of different organisations. And they quoted to me, in the UK, they talk about this thing that they call the purple pound, and that was the spending power of disabled households. And the last time that was measured in 2017, the spending power of the purple pound was estimated to be nearly $250 billion a year that those people were spending on UK businesses. So the evidence is definitely there that it does make business sense to be inclusive.
Talk to me a little bit more about the key findings that you felt were important to bring back to Australia.
So the organisations that were doing this really well, I identified five main success factors. So number one is that they just got started somewhere. So they didn't try and wait till they had all the answers figured out, you know, from every different angle for every different access service. But they got started and got up and running by doing something. And there was a quote from the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra that just said, doing nothing is not an option, you know, and you just need to do something. And the second success factor was around doing your research, listening to people and seeking feedback. And this is a lot around, I guess, community consultation, speaking to people with lived experience of disability about what it is that they want, what it is that they need, what are the ideas that they have in terms of how they could engage with your music service. The third success factor was around improving culture in organisations and responsibility for access. So this is sort of building on that idea of, while some organisations do have one person in them that is the access manager, trying to build that culture where access becomes everyone's responsibility, and that's something that the marketing team are thinking about when they're doing collateral, you know, the finance team are thinking about when they're doing their budget templates in terms of making sure there's a line in there for access. IT are thinking about from IT systems accessibility point of view, so really kind of building in that culture of accessibility across an organisation. The fourth success factor was around planning and continuous improvement. So a lot of this stuff you won't necessarily be able to do tomorrow, but make a plan and work out what the steps you need to take to get there are, and don't kind of set and forget. There's always more that you can be doing. Continuous improvement is about evaluating, monitoring, getting that feedback to keep making improvements year on year, particularly for things like festivals, which are annual.
Inclusion is a journey, not a destination, I think you said somewhere.
Absolutely. You know, there's no end point to it. There's always more you can do. And the fifth success factor was around connect and keep learning. So there's no need to do this in isolation. It's collaborating and working with other organisations, learning from each other. In places like Bristol, they have an equality network where organisations get together on, I think, a bi-monthly basis to talk about the work that they're doing around accessibility. I thought that was a really interesting idea. Most people were really open to sharing their learning. You know, there's kind of no need to reinvent the wheel when someone else down the road's already figured it out or already gone and bought the audio description kit. You know, why don't you go and borrow and share and, you know, work together on this stuff? So those were some of the key success factors that I identified through the research that I did.
So you've talked about the different parts of an organisation, but there's also what you would call all sections of the music ecosystem have a role to play, all the different types of organisations.
Absolutely.
You visited the lot. I mean, not only did you conduct all these interviews, but you also fitted in performances, workshops, training sessions.
I tried. I think one area that I touched on in the research, I'd love to do some more on in the future because I was too big to sort of really tackle it all, but I'm really interested in this, the role that training institutions play in all of this as well. So who's getting into music college? What is the access that's provided to the entry-level points of study for people to learn skills that they can then go on and use to have a career in music? So I visited a couple of the sort of classical and jazz conservatoria, like the Guildhall School in London, the Manhattan School of Music in New York, and probably the most interesting one I came across in terms of access was the Royal Conservatoire in Scotland. They're a conservatoire that does different art form areas. They've started a British Sign Language theatre course a number of years ago. And what that meant is that as a school now, most and students have had some sort of sign language training. They've found that more people with disability have been coming to that school because they've been seen to be an open and inclusive learning environment. So it is having flow-on effects to the music school within that conservatorium as well.
Morwenna, look, it's so interesting to have spoken to you before you went and hear about your expectations for the trip and now to hear how successful it was at the end. Best of luck with everything.
Oh, thank you so much, Barb.
You can hear the full interview with Morwenna Collette on the podcast section of our website. Morwenna's report on her Churchill Fellowship research can be found on churchilltrust.com.au.
You have just been listening to AbleQuest, a program that looks at developments in assistive technology. From Barbara Sullivan and Marnie Roper, thank you for listening and goodbye till next program.